We study billionaires, and this is episode 85 of the Investors Podcast.
Broadcasting from Bel Air, Maryland, this is the Investors Podcast. They'll read the books and summarize the lessons. They'll test the waters and tell you when it's cold. They'll give you actionable investing strategies. Your host, Preston Pish and Stig Broderson.
Hey, how's everybody doing out there? This is Preston Pish, and I'm your host for The Investors Podcast. And as usual, I'm accompanied by my co-host, Stig Broderson, out in Denmark. And I'll tell you what, we're going to have some people really excited about today's show, because our guest today is the one and only Jack Swagger from the famous compilation of books titled The Market Wizard Series. Here's a little bit on Jack, and I know that people listening to the show already know who you are. A lot of people listening to the show already know who you are, but if they don't, I'm just going to give a quick background so people know who you are, Jack. Jack got his degree in economics from Brooklyn College and also a master's in economics from Brown University. He's probably one of the most accomplished financial writers in the world, and he's interviewed countless billionaires and prodigies within the financial community. When you read one of Jack's books for the first time, you'll quickly realize that the person who's asking the questions in the book, which is Jack, is at par and just as smart as the person who's answering the questions. So Jack's the author of Market Wizards, The New Market Wizards, Stock Market Wizards, Hedge Fund Market Wizards, The Little Book of Market Wizards, The Complete Guide to Futures Markets, and Market Sense and Nonsense. So these books are not like 100-page books, all those books that I just listed. They're not like these short little 50-page or 150-page kind of books. In some cases, Jack's interviewed up to 20 different people that are total prodigies within finance. Like Ray Dalio, we talk about Ray all the time on our show. Jack's actually sat down and had an interview with billionaire Ray Dalio. So that's just one of the hundreds of people that he's sat down and actually interviewed. So with all of that, Jack, I want to jump to the questions, because the last thing I want to do is be the guy talking the whole time. We want to push the talking over to you so you can just share your knowledge with our community, because this is really exciting to have you on our show. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for that intro. Appreciate it.
So my question up front, knowing the caliber of people that you've sat down with, Jim Rogers, I mean, there's some people that you've interviewed that I'm big fans of. What was the one investor that you've interviewed that you were most impressed with? And what would be that one key takeaway that you had from that person's approach that you still keep with you today? What would be that one person and that one thing that you took away from all these interviews?
You know, it's like asking who's the greatest baseball player ever. You know, it's impossible to answer, really. I mean, totally. So I'm just going to not talk about these people now, because we'll probably get into some of them later. But just to throw out what I mean by that, you take somebody like Ed Thorpe, who had one of the best track records ever. I mean, so extraordinary that in one book I calculated the probability of getting that track record as being less than the amount of atoms in the entire mass of the earth. Now you take somebody with that, and by the way, his record in terms of return risk makes Dalio look like he doesn't know what he's doing. Obviously, yeah. But on the other case, Ray Dalio has made more money for investors than any other hedge fund or any other fund. Well, I don't know the mutual fund world, but any hedge fund that has ever existed, I think Dalio has made more money for the investors, as far as I know. Then you have somebody like Michael Marcus, who I know because I worked at the same firm that he did, that turned a $30,000 account into $80 million in the course of about a dozen years. Somebody like John Bender, who was a brilliant options trader who made literally hundreds of percent a year, physics background. I can go on and on and on. So how do you say who, and I haven't even mentioned people like Kovner, incredible investors ever. And somebody like Druckenmiller, like a 40-year track record with near 30% returns compounded. So how do you pick the best one? It's just not or the most impressive one. In terms of pure intellect and accomplishment, if you put a gun to my head, it might be Thorpe and Ed Thorpe. Now, for your audience, would probably know Ed Thorpe best not from his money management side, but they would know him because he wrote this famous book. Actually, his book sold more books than I did, Beat the Dealer. So that was not his only book, but that Beat the Dealer was the first book to tell people how to win a blackjack.
But that's the one that they built the whole movie around, where they went to Vegas and they were counting cards.
Yeah, so actually, because it's even more incredible than that, I'm just going to give you a few of the things here. Here's a guy, starts out, comes from a very poor background, grew up in a depression, teaches himself physics in high school, gets accepted, I forget to which California, one of the, you know, one of the top universities in California, gets, well, he didn't have his PhD yet in physics, was writing his thesis for his physics degree, decides he doesn't know enough math, goes and starts taking graduate math courses, gets his PhD in math, never actually goes back and writes his thesis, so he doesn't technically have a PhD in physics, then gets the idea that he'd like to beat casinos. It sounds completely preposterous. How can you be, not by cheating, by the way. And so the first scheme he comes up with is roulette. Now, when I first heard the concept that, hey, somebody says they could beat roulette, I said, it's impossible because we're thinking probability.
Yep.
But you don't think in terms of Newtonian physics, that what he literally got thought about was, well, if you could time it well enough, you could get by the physics. If you got this velocity of the ball between two different points and you knew its momentum and everything else, you could predict a probability of which octet of this wheel was more likely. This was back in the 60s. So we didn't have back in the 60s. I remember the 60s, even the late 60s. I remember using an IBM 360, which took up a better part of a room, and you had to use punch cards to do, you know, regressions or something like that. So, and he in the 60s developed this miniature computer way ahead of his time. And so this thing worked. They played for like minimal amounts of money. They just wanted to prove the concept. They had like a 40% edge in roulette. Then he came up with it. Then he read a paper by some math guys in, I forget where, that were saying win the blackjack from a mathematical standpoint. But what he came in with the insight was, hey, it's not a matter of how you just bet, because that's what these guys were trying to do. They were saying, if you bet all the right ways, if you hold on 16, you know, take the card, you know, the typical standard rules. If you did all the right bets, that actually turns out you still don't have the edge. You come very close. But he thought, he got the brilliant insight, wait a minute, who says you have to bet the same thing every time? So he kind of figured out that if you change the size of the bet, like when the more cards out, then, you know, you bet more picture cards out, you bet less, more, you know, less, you bet more, that could totally change your probabilities. And he was doing this and realized it would take him years and years, or actually more than years, maybe decades to do. So he had to find shortcuts, but he figured it all out and came up with this, a couple of methods actually, and then simplified. And I put a story in a book where there was an attempt on his life, just like out of the movies, like his car was fixed sort of, the brakes wouldn't work going down a hill. But in any case, so he did that, put out the book. That was the book that changed the casinos. We know the multiple decks, all of that, that's because of him.
Oh, yeah. So, Jack, would you say that the thing that you took away from Edward Thorpe was just his pure intellect? Was he just...
That was the thing that impressed me. It was just the intellect, just a raw intellect. He was a really nice guy, too, I got to tell you. I met a lot of brilliant people, but, I mean, Thorpe is probably the smartest guy I ever spoke to. And I've known people that made me feel stupid. But he didn't. When I say made me feel stupid, I don't mean that he made me feel stupid. It's just in comparison to his intellect, I just feel, but, you know, we're just not.
Is he like a voracious reader that got him there, or is he just?
It's just raw intellect. I just think he's got that talent. And that's how we beat the markets. He started to apply this intellect, this pure quant intellect to markets. And then you go on. First guy to start a market neutral fund. All these strategies, he's the first guy that does it and figures out how to do it and gets the edge. So not only brilliant, but innovative, thinking outside the box. He was the first guy to think of it. So he's an amazing guy. And people don't really know him to the extent they know some of the other big names. They know him for the Beat the Dealer book because it changed casinos and all that. But they don't know his hedge fund.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jack. I think he came up with a pricing model for warrants long before Black Scholes, like, you know, get all the fame for the options theory.
Thank you for reminding me. Yeah, maybe the biggest thing is everybody knows the Black Scholes model. Nobel Prize was given for the Black Scholes model. The amazing thing is Thorpe's trading a mathematical equivalent of the Black Scholes model 5 years before that article was ever published. He could have been the Nobel Prize winner, right? But that's not, he said. He was like the only guy in the world who knew how to price options, and he was just printing money. So he was, for that, until that article came out, he was just, he had like a printing press of money, because he just couldn't lose. He knew how to price options. Nobody else did.
He's like, I've already been doing that. I've been making millions of dollars doing that.
Yeah. That's part of the record. That part of his record is because he came up with all these things ahead of everybody else. That's how you get a record of something like, I think it was about 277, I forget the exact number, months. Three losing months out of 277, and all three of those were less than 1%. And that's why I say, you know, the probability, that's why the probability works out to be less than their, you know, less than picking one atom randomly out of the mass of the Earth.
Wow. You know, I'm so happy, Jack, that you mentioned it, Thorpe. I haven't told this story on the podcast, and this will be for another time, but he's actually the reason why I'm standing here today. So I'm so happy that you actually mentioned.
Oh, well, you should say, go on. I mean, I'll talk enough on this, but I'm curious how that happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's just very, very briefly. I read some of his material early on and was just very fascinated about his way of looking at everything as a game. I think perhaps that's really his true gift. And perhaps that was also why he didn't, you know, necessarily win the Nobel Prize. I mean, that was not the game he was playing, and how he was looking at casinos, and then afterwards, how he was looking at stocks, and how he was pricing options. And I think I started reading that around the age of, I want to say 20 or something. And that was really what made me make decision to go into all this that we're doing now, even though it's just a long time ago. So I feel I owe him a lot. And it's just rare that we have a chance to really talk about him and how influential he's really been on so many people and in so many different ways. For me, he's one of the most underrated out there in his own field, which is basically just really, really sad. Perhaps because he didn't want the fame, who knows?
Yeah, he's kind of not the... He tends to be a little quiet. He doesn't seek publicity for sure, you know, on the contrary.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Value investing in 2024 is lonely. You listen to the podcast and spend countless hours researching companies, but still feel like something is missing. What it is that you don't have others around you to help accelerate your learning efforts and your portfolio returns. This is exactly why we launched our TIP Mastermind community. In the TIP Mastermind community, we have nearly 100 passionate value investors joining our weekly live Zoom calls, sharing stock ideas, connecting with TIP hosts, joining our calls with special podcast guests like Chris Mayer and Gautam Bade, and most importantly, building lifelong relationships. We also host two live events per year in New York City and Omaha to take those relationships one step further. The TIP Mastermind community is exactly what I needed as an investor, so we decided to create it ourselves. Now I'm surrounded by so many like-minded investors who continually help me step up my game. We're capping the group at 150 members, so if you'd like to learn more, you can visit theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. That's theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. When Rain Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, Sleep with Rain was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Kyle, you're connected with a ton of different investors and portfolio managers, and you're just really in the know on a lot of these things. How do you keep up with all the day-to-day headlines for your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so I used to have a ton of issues with this, and that was until I started using Yahoo Finance.
Really? What's so great about it?
So Yahoo Finance is awesome. I have my whole portfolio entered and I can easily see all the top headlines to keep up with the recent news. And each day you get an overview of the major global events that might be moving the market. So I'm ready to easily pounce on any opportunities that come my way.
What else can you do on Yahoo Finance's platform?
They also have a number of cool features, including a tool that lets you link all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts.
Well, now I know that the audience is really going to love this one. And I actually see they have 90 million monthly active users.
For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com.
The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show. We were completely shifting gears here, Jack. So one thing that I know that we completely agree upon is how important it is to have independence in your strategy, whether it is investing or trading. And you have this quote from the famous trader Michael Marcus saying, "You have to follow your own light." So still we can get swayed by other people that we consider really smart, even if these people might follow another strategy. So I would like to ask you, could you please tell your personal story about not shorting the yen back when you were director of Futures Market?
This was after I'd done the first book, and I'm not going to mention a name here deliberately, but one of the traders I interviewed would call me from time to time, and he would call me and ask my technical opinion on the markets. And I never knew why, because he was like a million times better trader than I was. Why he would want my opinion, I don't know. But he would do that, and we'd talk. So one day he calls, and we're going through the markets, and it had to put this in context. Okay, this was a year I started off. I made money. I was ahead. Then dribbling of money. I was losing. And I'd given back most of the money I made. I was still ahead, but not by very much. I decided to sort of cut back. I had like one position left of any consequence, maybe had something else, but just really one. And he gets to that market, this is Japanese yen. Got to picture this, what the chart looks like. It had a very sharp decline, like a falling off the cliff. And then it went into a very, very tiny consolidation, really, really thin. And he gets to the yen. And I said, well, you know, when I've seen a pattern like this, where the market's down extremely steeply and then goes into a tiny consolidation, most of the time it'll go down again. And he says, well, no, Jack, you know, he gives me 58 reasons why. I said, hey, you know, well, you're probably right. It's just an opinion, you know. So anyway, so I hang up the phone. And I knew, like I said, I knew I should not listen to other people. I knew that. And I normally wouldn't. I really think I wouldn't have. However, this is where fate intercedes. That afternoon, I had to travel for a few days to go to Washington, D.C. I knew I had a lot of meetings. I'd be busy. This was pre smartphones and all that. And I wasn't going to even have a computer of any sort to look at anything. So I said to myself, well, you know, I haven't been doing so well lately. I've got this one trade for good profit. You know, here's one of the smartest guys, one of the best traders I know, who's on the opposite side of this trade. Do I really want to fade him on the trade? So I go over to the overnight desk and I get out of the position. Okay, I come back a couple of days later. I don't know where the market is. I'm not following the market. Come back a couple of days later. You and your listeners will probably know the next thing. You know, sure, the yen's down a few hundred points, right? Okay, so that's no surprise. We know that's going to happen. Now, here's where the surprise is. And this is, I tell people, honestly, I'm not making this up. I couldn't make this up. That day he calls again. I wasn't going to be so gaucious to bring up the yen. You know, it's like, hey, everybody can be wrong. I'm not going to say anything, but he brings it up. So I say, hey, are you still long? And he exclaims to me, long? He says, I'm short. Now, what I didn't tell you is, for me, I traded positions, particularly at the time, for like months at a time. You know, for him, a long-term trade was like 2 days. When he was speaking to me, he was bullish because he was looking for a bounce. The market probably didn't bounce. He probably decided it wasn't acting right, or maybe went down a little bit, got out, went the other way. So he made money, and I was right all along, ended up not making anything. So it's like a perfect example. You can't listen to anybody. It's going to mess you up. And going back to Marcus, that great quote, you have to follow your own light. Mm-hmm. The rest of that quote, paraphrasing, is you could take the best traders in the world, two of the best traders in the world, and put them together, and you'll get the worst of each. And incidentally, he was speaking about, I know he was speaking about, Michael Marcus hired Bruce Kovner, who then went on to form Caxton, one of the great legends of trading and investing. He had hired a Kovner, and for a time, they traded from the same office. So they talked, whatever. So when he says that, he's talking about himself and Kovner. So literally, two of the world's best traders. And he's still saying that if they don't stay true to their own approach, they're still going to get messed up if they try to trade like the other guy does.
I've got a kind of a follow-up question that really hits at the point you're getting at, and that's matching your style or your personality with your investing approach, and it has to do with Jule Greenblatt. So I know that you are close with Jule. I know he's endorsed some of your books. You've interviewed him a couple times, and Jule has some books out there that really kind of take Warren Buffett's approach and make it a lot simpler, and he calls it his magic formula. And after interviewing him, do you think that people out there could simply pick up his two books and really kind of implement this magic formula and get the fantastic results that he's had? And please tell our audience Joel Greenblatt's results, because he has really high returns in the years. And what kind of personality do you see that really kind of gets attracted to the Joel Greenblatt approach?
I've heard of Greenblatt, and then I dug up the track record, and it ended like, I did the book in 2012. His track record ended in 1995. It's a while ago. Now, it was a very interesting track record. It was about 10 years long. It had all winning years, of course. The worst year he had was like a profit of about 28%. That was his low year. And that was like, and remember, in that period, you had 87 crash, you had 94, which is a bear market. And his worst year was a positive 28, 29%. So, and then with the NAV at an all-time high, the fund disappears. My first question to Greenblatt was, why did you close the fund? I mean, who closes a fund in 10 years where the worst year is plus 28%? He said that he had just gotten too big, that he couldn't do the trades managing other people's money. Because he was doing a lot of sort of value-oriented trades, which might have been involved some smaller cap stocks. They couldn't do them.
Like he was doing net nets on small cap. Is that
some stuff like that? He was doing different. He was doing a lot of different strategies. But it's the Buffett philosophy of buying of a value orientation. And so that's what that is at his heart. That's in his bones. And in fact, I'll go to your question. I'll get to your question in a moment about whether people can use the formula. Let me just give you this aside, because part of what I do for the interview, I try to do different things to get to know people in the interview process. It's not just like I sit down with them for 1 hour or whatever. But in Greenblatt's case, I met him a couple of times, but I also went, he was teaching a course at Columbia. He was teaching a course on the markets on the graduate school level in Columbia. And so I sat in on one of the courses. For this particular session, he had said, well, okay, today I'm going to be Buffett, that you guys ask me questions, you ask me questions and I'll answer them. And so the class was asking questions, he's answering them, and they were getting completely confused. They said, well, wait a minute, are you answering this as Buffett or are you asking this as Professor Greenblatt? They couldn't tell. I couldn't tell either. It sort of went back and forth between the two. So basically this whole question of, and let me give you this other thing, which will answer your question indirectly, but in a more interesting way, as whether people can use the formula. So he did this study using this magic formula, or more advanced form of it or whatever. And then it ranked the stocks going forward based upon a formula. And it turns out that the top decile over a longer period of time, the top decile, did the best. The second decile did the second best. The third decile and the lowest decile did the worst and lost a little bit of money. So my first question, being a kind of an analytical guy and broad investing, the first question that sort of pops up to my mind, which is so obvious, is, hey, why buy the top decile? Why don't you buy the top decile and sell the lowest decile simultaneously? You'll have a balanced portfolio, presumably much less risk, and actually more return because the lowest decile actually lost a little bit of money. So to me, it seemed like, hey, that's such an obvious thing. How come you didn't do that? So he says, yeah, that's a good question. That's also a question a number of my students asked. And they said, there's only one reason that I didn't do that. He said, I would have gotten wiped out if I did that. And the reason he explained was, good example, late 1990s. Late 1990s, stocks are going crazy. Everybody thinks, well, tremendous bull market, S&P's up 20-30%, NASDAQ's going through the roof, the internet craze, stocks are going from 10 to 200. Okay, everybody knows all that stuff, right? You forget that really the value stocks, a lot of value stocks weren't only going up, they might have been losing money, right? So you've got an atmosphere here where the worst garbage is going on its way from 10 to 200 before it goes back to 1 or 0, right? But you've got that interim period where it's going to 200. So you get a period where the really crummy stocks are going up tremendously and the good stocks are losing. What does that mean? That means if you've got 100%, you've actually lost more than 100% of your money. And he literally would have gotten wiped out doing that. So while in most years that strategy looks like much better return to risk, in that situation you get killed.
So it's interesting. We had a guest. Do you know Wesley Gray? He's a hardcore quant guy. Really awesome. But we got to introduce you to Wes, because he's just a wealth of information. He runs around with Patrick O'Shaughnessy and James O'Shaughnessy in that group. But one of the things that he did was a lot of research on what you're talking about exactly, where when you get into a really high market valuation period, kind of like where we're at right now, growth picks do extremely well and maybe not what you would necessarily think, but then they just fall off a knife's edge whenever the value picks really start doing well when the market starts having a major downturn. So it's really interesting that you kind of got the same feedback and the same information from Joel Greenblatt when you were talking. I really find that interesting.
And we've
talked about this on our show when we had Wes on. It's a really interesting discussion. I know Wesley Gray has a lot of published articles on it. Maybe we can throw some of those into the show notes to kind of complement this discussion. But awesome feedback. Thank you for that, Jack. That is awesome.
Yeah, and also, so what Greenblatt says, and this is kind of, it's cute but true. So he has his three rules of value investing. He said, first rule is value investing works. The second rule is value investing doesn't work all the time. And rule number three is rule number two is while rule number one works. If anything worked all the time, enough people would use it would stop working. And it's because you get a 99 that value investing still works. Because if it was just a matter of buying undervalued stocks and staying with them, then everybody would do it. And it would just, you know, but it would stop, the edge would go away. But so anyway, that's his explanation. So the answer to the magic formula is it'll work most years, but there'll be times where it doesn't work. And it could be a prolonged time.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Clay Fink. Before I became a host on We Study Billionaires, I hosted one of our other podcasts called Millennial Investing. Kyle Grieve and Patrick Donnelly have done an incredible job now hosting that show and taking it to the next level. For example, Kyle recently hosted an amazing episode with Chris Mayer on episode 310 that gave a masterclass on serial acquirers. Serial acquirers are a very interesting business model with very strong multi-bagger potential. This makes them potentially the dream business for stock pickers like us. Kyle also hosted some other amazing episodes packed full of timeless investing wisdom with guests like Lawrence Cunningham, Robert Hagstrom, and Brian Feraldi. Millennial Investing, along with We Study Billionaires, is definitely one you should add to your arsenal of top podcasts. Check it out today by searching for Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and clicking the follow button. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? For me, nothing beats having my next flight free thanks to NerdWallet. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show. So Jack, one thing that's really interesting about Joe Greenblatt is that he's thinking as a trader, but also as an investor. So many investors, they think in terms of buying a stock, hopefully would be undervalued, and then the price will eventually go up. Now, traders, they also think in terms of leveraging their own position, not necessarily using debt, But if they have a really strong opinion about where a stock is going, they might be able to get a higher payoff. One of those ways to do that is using an option. And I know that you have a very interesting story about your good friend John Greenblatt and how he used options to invest in Wells Fargo back in the early 1990s.
Yeah, so to set that up, I should say, because people have a misconception about options being more risky and so forth. They can be more risky. The way most people use them, they are probably more risky. But the idea here is, and the way some great investors have used them that I've spoken to, and Greenblatt's one of them, this is one of the ways he got such a great track record. And somebody like in the hedge fund market was like Jamie Mays, a guy who really trades like that all the time. The math of the option market is that assumes there's always an equal chance of a market going up or stock going up or stock going down. And these traders realize, or investors realize, that there are points in time where that's not necessarily true. The natural pricing of an option to be symmetrical in terms of percentage gain and percentage loss is not going to be correct. And so in this case, with Wells Fargo, he realized, well, this is Wells Fargo is a very, very solid stock. It was a very, very strong company. However, at the time they had their book contained a lot of real estate in California, and California was having the real estate market was having real problems. So there was concern about the bank. But Greenblatt thought that they'd be fine. But he said, basically, there's two possibilities. If this is really going to be a problem, they're going to go bust, then it's going to be a zero. And if, like, I think it's going to be okay, then the stock is like tremendously underpriced. It should triple, quadruple, whatever. So his play was, and of course, he didn't want to just buy the stock and leave himself, take that bet, hold it till it goes to zero, that take a chance of that. What he did instead was buy out of the money options. And his thinking was, when they're out of the money option, you're basically not going to get paid unless the market goes up, or in this case, the stock goes up significantly. However, it's relatively cheap. You put up a small amount of money. In this case, if the stock goes down, goes sideways, or only goes up moderately, he loses that amount. But it's a small percentage of the total cost of the stock. However, if it gets to the strike price, and let alone if it goes well beyond the strike price, then you start getting multiples of your money. And so to him, it seemed like a really good play because the market was saying, hey, there's like a 50-50 shot of Wells Fargo going broke versus, you know, being okay. Where in his mind, it was much better than a 50-50 shot they'd be okay. And he played it in a way that if he was right, he'd get paid multiples of what he was risking. So that was the basic concept of the trade. You know, the end of that story is, I don't know, went up like four times or whatever.
400% return.
Yep.
So Jack, one of the things that I really liked about your book is some of the people that you've interviewed through the years really kind of have just crazy or like really interesting approaches to making money, and they're successful at it. That's the thing that's just so mind-blowing for me. Like, one example that comes to mind was the guy from your hedge fund book, the Hedge Fund Market Wizards book, where he was breaking all the phones and just kind of seemed like he had this wild and rampant personality. And then another one was the gentleman that your son worked for, who was actually betting in the exact opposite direction of whatever the market was trending, and yet he was still able to make money. So I guess my question is this, is what was one of the more interesting investing approaches that you've come across with all these different interviews? What would you say that you took away from interviewing that person that maybe you could actually apply to your own approach?
Boy, so it's a really bifurcated question, because the latter part of that is like, what did I take away and what I learned, that type of stuff. And there's lots of answers to that. And that's has a positive answer. Then you began with a couple of people, and the second one you mentioned, the one that my son worked for, Jimmy Baladimas. If you go through books, one of the things you note is, or most people realize, is, hey, all these guys are doing something different. You know, it's like they're just nothing like each other. It's not like a bunch of guys doing the same thing. So you got people all over the map. However, if your question had been, who was the most different trader, you know, style-wise, who used the most different approach versus everybody else, it would be Jimmy Baladimas. Because here's a guy who's using an approach that it just flies in the face of everybody. You know, it's just counter to everybody's advice. It's counter to what everybody does. It's something like, if you told me somebody does what Baladimas does, I said, this guy's going to blow up in a year or two. And he's been doing it for, I don't know, 20 years, whatever he's been doing it for. First of all, what does he do? So what Jimmy Baladimas does is he has this personality where he has to be opposite everybody. He can't stand to be, he always has to be fighting everybody. He has to be on the opposite side of everybody. And the more people are crazy about something, the more he wants to be on the opposite side of it. So you get markets where extreme markets like, and he trades both stocks and commodities, but to talk about some of the commodity examples, because they're the really extreme ones. If your audience might remember silver, well, I don't know how, 4 or 5 years, 6 years ago, I forget exactly what year it was, but where silver was really going straight up and it went all the way up into the 40s and eventually got to low 50s. Well, and it's going almost vertical. Who's selling silver? Well, there's Jimmy selling silver right into that uptrend at 45, 46, you know. And, you know, you had cotton market. The cotton market that had, since the Civil War, had never gone to a dollar, goes to like more than above $2. And it does the last part in just a very short period of time. Just like another cliff. And who's selling cotton when it's like $2? That's Baldemus. So he steps in front of freight trades. And not only that, it'd be one thing if he did that and then just held the position when the markets eventually crashed. But then on the first good break, he takes his profits. It's like insane. But no, he has to find something else to fight. So that's the style he does. And the reason why, and you know, and by the way, I say in that book, the first line of that chapter is Jimmy Baldemus breaks all the rules. And the first line of my conclusion to that chapter is, or first line or second line is something along the line is, don't try this at home. You know, nobody trade this way. I don't want anybody to trade this way. How do I know he's for real? Because my son worked for him. And so he arranged the interview and all that. So I knew my son worked in the firm and everybody knew that Jimmy was like this guy who produces multi-billion dollar results almost every year. First day I go to interview him, set the scene. This is like the end of the first quarter. I forget which year it was, but it was a year. It was like 2011, I think. But it was one of those years where the stock market was going up almost every day. And the first quarter had been up pretty steadily. And that March, the month I went to visit him, it was one of those days the market couldn't go more than 3 or 4 days without making a new high. So if you were like short, I mean, you couldn't catch your breath. It was just like down a day, up again, you know, like, and so at the end of the month, very end of the month, last day of the month, I think it was, the market's down 2%. And so there was some story about, I think, Libya or something, and there was some excuse for the market to go down and sold off. And so I go into his office, and he's got the monitors, my son's there too, and all the screens are like all red. Everything's like all red, because that was the day the market was down, right? And it turned, sure enough, of course, he's been short everything, right? So, but it's one day the market's down. And first of all, he's there. Good deals is like, you figure a guy's been short, a market's going straight up. Finally a day, the market's down 2%. Everything, the whole screen's red, he's short. You think of the guy would be like, who would know if he won or lost that day? If I came on a day he was losing, he'd be the same way. He's just like, you know, that's the way it was. How's the guy short a market that goes up every day, virtually not every day, but it's going up almost every day of the month, gets one day where it's down and still ends up breaking even? How do you do that? So the thing is, and this is where he makes the money. This is where his skill is. And this is something you can't teach. But he's always taking profits. He's always taking money off the table. So he's short a stock, and it's a terrible trade. The stock's going to go from 50 to 100, but he's short. So he goes short, let's say he's short at 50. The stock ticks that opens up 49.5. He sells some of it, goes up 51, you know. I mean, I'm sorry, he buys it back. And then goes up to 51, he'll sell it again. So he's constantly taking these small little profits along the way. And so even though he's wrong in the trend, he's making these profits on these, because he's just capturing money off the table continuously. And he's doing about 500 trades a day, according to my son. So that's how he was making his money. But he could have made a lot more money if he did the same thing with the trend, but he insisted on doing it against the trend. So
to me, it just seems like that you would eventually blow up with using that approach. But you're saying he's been doing it
for a long time. And I can't tell you how. I would have been the first one to say the same thing, Preston. I would have been the first one. And I would have said it's impossible. Nobody could trade this way. And maybe he won't get away with it forever. But it's been a long, long time where he's been doing it. And so, yeah, I don't think anybody should. I really mean it. Don't trade that way. It's 9,999 people out of 10,000 will go broke doing this. And the last one out of 1,000 will lose 80% of their money. So nobody trades.
This wraps up our first part interview with Jack Swager. Stay tuned for the next episode where we continue the discussion with Jack and learn more about fundamentals in trading and how to measure your performance in investing.
Thanks for listening to The Investor's Podcast. To listen to more shows or access to the tools discussed on the show, be sure to visit www.theinvestorspodcast.com. Submit your questions or request a guest appearance to The Investor's Podcast by going to www.asktheinvestors.com. If your question is answered during the show, you will receive a free autographed copy of the Warren Buffett Accounting Book. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. This material is copyrighted by the TIP Network and must have written approval before commercial application.